morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Esser.
Good morning, Your Honors. I have a couple of corrections I'd like to make before I start off. At page 25 of the opening brief, I think it's argument D, there's a reference to findings in the first paragraph at the top of page 25, which indicates that I'm challenging findings 215 to 219. That is a typo, which refers to the findings that are challenged in the next section. That should read 191 to 203, and those are the findings that are described on page 124. It wasn't noted in the answering brief, but it's confusing, so I want to correct that. The other correction I want to make, and I make this one with a little bit of an apology, is in the reply brief, I indicate at pages 7 and 8 that the court below made no findings that my client was at fault for the continuances or that there was prejudice to Mr. Weinberg, and that is simply not true. There are many findings that, in fact, address that, and I apologize for that oversight. This is a complex case with a lot of factual questions on some of the issues, but most of the issues seem to be basically turning on questions of law, and I'm going to primarily focus on those questions of law. There are a lot of facts that have been argued in terms of the continuance and the alimony issues. We don't have the time to go through all those things at this point. Obviously, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. But there are some very interesting and significant, and in some cases, first impression legal issues, so I'd like to do that. And I'd like to start off in terms of the chronological with the AICD, called AITD by opposing counsel. The agreement incident to divorce was signed, I believe, in April 2004, and there was a motion to enforce in September 2005, about 14 months later. So we have a 14-month delay. Now, what happened during those 14 months is actually largely uncontested. The intent of the parties in terms of how they testified at the hearing in front of Judge Radius is contested. But the facts are pretty much not contested. There was an AICD. There was a action which was allowed to lapse. There was no request to reinstate it. These are all uncontested facts. There was a new action filed in December 2004 that is essentially identical, not contested. The answer to that action did not mention the AICD, again, uncontested. And there was a mediation. Now, that's strictly contested because it's our position that under 408 that it shouldn't have even been considered. When you go into mediation, you don't waive some of your rights under 408. You don't waive any. And frankly, if you look at the record at the October 24th, 2005 hearing, Judge Radius actually sustained two objections under 408 to introduction of mediation documents. So her finding, I guess it's her finding, it's hard to tell which is judge finding in the 86 pages of findings, but her finding number 33, that mediation AICD wasn't mentioned, it contradicts her lower court ruling excluding information from mediation. It also violates 408. But what I'd like you to focus on is not so much the written findings, which were, of course, signed unchanged and drafted by opposing counsel, but to look at the oral discussion at the hearing and to look at the written ruling below. Now, I understand the findings ultimately bind are the final statement of the court, or at least to the extent we know what Judge Radius's participation in those 86 pages were. But primarily, she threw out this very exhaustive, very thorough agreement, which was written by lawyers after consultation with lawyers, for two reasons. And that is the uncontested thing I mentioned a minute ago, which is that the first divorce action was allowed to lapse, and there was no motion for reinstatement, and there was a new action. And then her second finding is somewhat vague. It says that in the year since, that the actions of the parties and the financial transactions suggest that it's been abandoned. Those are the two findings.
Can I ask a question? At what point, in your view, at what point in the litigation would it have been too late for your client to refer to the agreement in contemplation of divorce. In other words, it can't be that you could wait till the trial's over and the court made a property division and said, oh, we had this agreement. So at what point in the litigation, I assume at some point in litigation, your position would be she would have to attempt to enforce it. At what point would that be?
Well, I guess I'll answer that by saying that we didn't reach that point because there was an answer filed, period, and pretty much nothing else. I guess you could say the position statement. I guess you could say the settlement conference, not the mediation, which is a different thing, but the settlement conference. I guess you could say the first day of trial. There's a lot of different dates you could pick, but all there is in this case is an answer and some discovery.
Well, what about the discovery, though? Was the discovery limited to the husband's asset and debt statement that was filed? You know, but that was the only clause in the agreement that allowed your client to get out of it.
That's
was
right.
The discovery request limited to information that would either verify the accuracy of the asset and debt statement, or did it go beyond that?
I know that the primary focus was on how much money he was making. He apparently filed an asset and debt statement in March of 2004, which said he was making $42,000 a month. And there was some question later on when the second action was filed as to whether the assertions made in those asset and debt statements and income and expense statements were accurate. And as you pointed out, there is a phrase in the settlement agreement that says that the parties can get out if the underlying, it's sort of like the this case the Supreme Court addressed a few years ago, the whole idea of settlement fraud, whether or not if you settle a case based on false discovery or false information, you can set aside an agreement. You don't even need that information in the, or that remedy in the agreement, Your Honor, to set aside a settlement because there's Hawaii Supreme Court authority, you can't.
But if the discovery went beyond that limited basis, wouldn't that suggest conduct inconsistent with an intent to enforce or a lack of abandonment of the agreement?
I don't think I can stand here and say that there was no conduct inconsistent. I can't say that. I think it's a question of what the burden is and what this court is faced with. And the position that I think you have to start with is these cases, and agree they're not Hawaii cases, mainland cases that say it takes clear and convincing evidence. There was certainly some reconciliation, and there are some states that say the reconciliation, most of them say, like the Drink case, that standing alone it doesn't. But clearly if you're making up, that's inconsistent with proceeding. So there are some things that are inconsistent.
Under our case law, reconciliation is not a factor, right?
I think it certainly is a factor if it's accompanied by an express desire to set aside the agreement. Clearly, that's what Dring says, and that's what most of the foreign state cases say. What we're saying is reconciliation alone is not enough, and that's what Dring holds as a matter of law.
And Kuroda.
And what I'd like to have this court focus on, first of all, it's my position, even though it's argued to the contrary in the answering brief, that this issue of abandonment is before this court de novo. To me, the Dring Court makes clear that the underlying facts are reviewed for clearly erroneous, but that the determination of abandonment is a ruling of law that this court rules de novo. The other question, of course, is enforcement of settlement agreements and the State Farm case, which makes it clear that whether you enforce a settlement agreement, of which there is a very strong public policy in favor of, is in front of this court de novo. So the question is, and again, Your Honor, I agree there are actions contrary. The question is there near enough? Is the time period enough? And what did the trial court focus on? Judge Radius asked the parties a very important question, and when it was answered, she ruled. And that is, does it make any difference that the previous action was allowed to lapse and it wasn't reinstated? That's why we cited the Vela case, which is right on point, that says that doesn't matter. And we also cited the statement on page 2 of the agreement that says this agreement will be admitted into any action. It doesn't say the pending action. In fact, there's no reference in the settlement agreement to the pending action. It clearly is to be addressed and to be used in any action. And the court did not address that language below. And to me, that language alone raises a very strong argument, presumption, that this applies in the second action as well, especially when it's exactly the same thing.
Is there any evidence that Mrs. Weinberg knew that she could rely on that agreement? Did her attorneys tell her she could and she rejected that advice? I mean, I know we're getting into attorney-client privilege here, but...
Yeah, that was one of the problems. The other problem is that it was contested, and of course there's a load of findings prepared by opposing counsel taking advantage as much as he could of those credibility rulings. There was a question of the $5,000 payments, whether that was paid pursuant to the agreement or whether it was paid pursuant to something else. The continuation of her support until it was entered into the record. The only thing I would say is the first contested hearing in the second divorce action, the first time the parties came to court and argued about anything, was that apartment in L.A. They filed a motion to have both those properties immediately sold. And as soon as that got in front of a judge, the first contested hearing, perhaps that's when you deliver your AICD. The first contested hearing, she responded with an attachment of that agreement. And it was, again, about 14 months later.
To enforce that agreement all along, she could have moved for summary judgment right after the answer was filed and resolve. In other words, your opposing counsel argues, hey, it's not fair to have the other party engage in all this litigation expense and then wait on the road, spring this agreement that would have obviated the need for all this litigation. So it seems to me that there should be some negative inference drawn from the failure to raise this agreement that would obviate the need for this litigation at some point early in the proceeding, whether when she raised it was too late or too early, but I think at some point fairly early in the proceedings that should be raised.
I agree. I can't disagree with that. And like I said before, I acknowledge that there are actions contrary or inconsistent. I would argue that what had occurred in the 14 months between the signature and the motion to enforce was pretty much Manini. I mean, we're talking about drafting a complaint that had already been drafted, in other words, just copying it and filing it. We're talking about some discovery. Now, the mediation, arguably, was expensive because it did go on for a long time. So they spent some money in mediation. It seems to me that, first of all, this court can't consider what was discussed in mediation, at least not fairly, and especially they can't discuss settlement agreements discussed in mediation. That's like compounding the whole idea of what mediation's for. So if you remove the mediation, which we contend you should, and again, I'm not going to argue what was brought up in mediation because that would be inconsistent with my position, but I assume the fight in mediation was, did you tell me the truth a year ago when you filed that asset and debt statement? But, you know, I have no idea what was raised in mediation. I haven't looked at it, and I don't want to look at it, and I don't think this court should look at it. What we should look at is how much money, because I agree, Your Honor, if you'd been through a lot of litigation before this was disclosed, but again, what's the record say? What does the index, the record on appeal say? There's about a page of documents, and if you remove the mediation, there's very little that was done in this case. But let's assume that opposing party was somehow harmed. I don't know why opposing counsel and opposing party waited 14 months themselves to come out with this agreement. I mean, Judge Radius found that he signed it. She implied that it wasn't unconscionable. She found that there was an agreement. The only reason that she ruled against us is because she found it abandoned. So it isn't like this was a secret to the other side. It may have been a secret to opposing counsel if his client didn't tell him about it. But I mean, he read it and signed it and then hired a lawyer and paid him to write it. So what's the surprise?
Did the attorneys in the first case actually have a copy of the signed agreement? It sounded like she got him to sign it and then took it to L.A. and gave it to her mother for safekeeping, so nobody even knew that it was signed.
Again, he's taking the position he never signed it, okay? He put on a handwriting expert and said, I've never seen this thing before. He even said he hadn't read it. But with the court finding, Your Honor, that there is an agreement, I mean, he read it, he signed it, was represented by counsel. I mean, having a copy of what he signed, you know, I understand that. And that was, by the way, a factual issue at the hearing. It wasn't really resolved, and there's no findings by the judge, either the ending findings or her order as to how that came down. The bottom line is, he was a party to this agreement. And it's a very careful, exhaustive agreement. It even provides for an equalization payment, which of course suggests that it is not unconscionable and it's completely even-handed. So again, I don't think they can argue surprise, except possibly new counsel. And again, if new counsel didn't know about it, that's his client's fault. That's not my client's fault. If he signs an agreement that promises his client $672,000 in alimony and he doesn't bother to show him a copy of it or tell him about it, I don't see how that's evidence of either prejudice or abandonment.
So if we agree with you that this agreement was not abandoned, then the rest of the issues go away?
Oh, yes. Yes. Because the judge specifically found that it was, that they entered an agreement. Yes, and in fact, with all my heart, I would like this case to stop right there. As much as I think my client was denied a fair trial, I hesitate to say this, but I really don't want you to send this back for another trial, and I'm sure they don't either. What I would like this case to be done is to be resolved by that AICD. And again, if you look at the figures in there, you don't have to look outside the agreement. It's a very even-handed agreement. It comes out about $100,000 in favor of the other side. And with the equalization payment, the parties are admitting that it's essentially an equal division.
But you agree we are bound by, at least under the clearly erroneous standard, we have to comply with or abide by the lower court's factual findings.
Yes, except that I do think you have to disregard the findings on mediation because I think they're improper and inconsistent with her rulings below.
But essentially her findings were the conduct of your client taking the inferences that were drawn by the court indicated that your client had, by her conduct, abandoned the agreement. So how do we overcome the inferences drawn by the lower court in construing her conduct in a way that the court found led to the conclusion that there was abandonment?
Well, that's the problem. Without specific findings. I mean, if you look at the finding in her order, this statement that you sort of just characterized, which is this vague thing of, gee, they've been doing things for the last year that are inconsistent, there's no way I can counter that because I don't know what she's referring to. If you go to the findings that were drafted by opposing counsel and signed unchanged, then there are a couple of extra things thrown in there. And as I said, the mediation shouldn't be there. He points out the Rule 68 orders, which were not mentioned by the judge below. I'm not sure that the Rule 68 orders mean anything either. Frankly, Your Honor, what I'm looking at is was allowing one case to lapse, filing an identical one without reinstating it, filing an answer that doesn't raise it, going through some discovery, and then a first contested hearing when this is brought up.
So you're saying that it would be clearly erroneous from those undisputed facts to draw inferences that would indicate abandonment?
I do, because if you look at the way the judge conducted the hearing, that second paragraph in her ruling was clearly an afterthought. She asked the parties, would it make a difference if you allowed one action to lapse and did not move to reinstate it and allowed a second action to proceed? That was what she ruled on. It was the first thing in her oral order. It was the first thing in her written order. It's the reason she ruled. That at least suggests that. And again, it isn't before this court as clearly erroneous. It's before this court as de novo, both in terms of abandonment and deciding not to enforce an agreement. And I'd also point out, the only case cited in the answering brief, I think it's the Leipert case, I may be misstating that, they cite a prenup case, which of course is really inapposite, because a prenup case is not settling something that's already been engaged. So the whole public policy behind settling cases, which is enormous, and this whole thing of clearly erroneous and setting aside and de novo, all of the emphasis on the importance of settling a divorce case. I've seen a lot of AICDs in the last 30 years, and I've never seen one so completely thorough and dot I cross T as this one. That really the only question was whether it was unconscionable and whether it was the signature, and the judge found both those. I'd like to move on if I could. I understand that's certainly the sexiest issue to me, and that's what I'd like to walk away from here with, but I also feel like I need to briefly address the other issues. I do think there is a very interesting series of conjoined issues in front of this court on the valuation of the law practice. John Kenden is as good as they come in terms of being the top of his profession in valuating businesses. He's testified in a lot of cases. The problem with him in this case is his hands were tied. His hands were tied by his opinion that contingency fees are speculative, which is a legitimate perspective. A minority group of courts agree with him. And this other one, which is this 21-year-old Antelik case, a case that's never been upheld by the Hawaii Supreme Court, a case that basically takes the businesses of professionals in the state of Hawaii and takes them out of the 580-47, says these can't be evaluated, no matter how much money they're making, no matter if they're making $10 million a year. You can't consider the earnings in a situation like this because it has to be marketable, and you can't market a chiropractor's or a lawyer's or a doctor's earning capacity. You take the combination of those two rulings, Your Honors. One ruling is, I'm not going to consider any earnings whatsoever over the last 10 years, and he literally refused to consider anything before or after Dofscod, before or after Doak Pot. He did not consider one penny of earnings under Antelik. And then he turns around and Lucas asks him, opposing counsel, what about all these active case files? He has millions of dollars of cases out there. And we have quite a bit of testimony, 15 or 20 pages, where Jan is very forthright about a huge number of cases that were pending, a $3 million case, a couple of million-dollar cases that settled just after Condon's report was filed. And he was then asked, well, aren't those a factor? You know, aren't those marital property? And he said, absolutely not one penny. And he gave some reasons. And we've supplied case law, which is followed in about 10 states, and the other side supplied 5 states. One of their cases, the Maryland case, the Quinn case, is miscited because in Maryland you, in fact, can consider contingency fee cases in divorce cases. So they have basically 4 states. I think it's Florida, Oklahoma, Georgia, and Pennsylvania. We cite 10 states and Professor Oldman. And all those, a number of those decisions specifically use the word majority. But more importantly, what we'd like this court to do is look at the Estes case and look at the rationale, because it addresses this issue, most of the issues of concern that are raised in the answering brief and also in those minority decisions. I think Gussin compels both Antelik being overruled and contingency fee cases to be part of a marital settlement. Now, in one of the biggest problems with this contingency fee issue is how do you evaluate it at Doak Pot? And there's certainly a public policy in favor of resolving these valuations right then and not holding them open, which you'd essentially have to do. You do essentially the same thing, though, with the Linson formula in pension cases. You don't resolve exactly what the division is in a pension, in a divorce decree. You just get an agreement signed that says if and when the pension starts, you add up the premarital and the postmarital, and that's how you do it. And of course, a pension, like a contingency fee, is also something that you don't know the value of at the Doak Pot.
So do you have a formula? I mean, Linson has a formula. How do we evaluate?
The formula is in Estes, Your Honor. I just invite you to read that case. It suggests a pretty clear formula. So does Professor Oldman. And I think it's the Garrett case from Arizona. Both those cases say, we refuse to disregard the single most important asset in these divorces, which is certainly true of this one. I mean, the apartment and the house were small potatoes compared to this $2 million a year law firm. And what they're essentially saying is just because it's difficult to figure out how to evaluate it, we can't just disregard it entirely, which is, of course, what Antelik did, although Antelik's not a contingency fee case, but it's a similar situation. It's saying, hey, there's a problem, so let's just throw it out. And the combination of those contingency fees going out and the all earnings prior essentially leave us with a bunch of adding machines. And frankly, I reread Candon's report last night, and he talks a lot about business machines and a Jaguar and accounts receivable, and he just ignores the sole reason that this man is such a successful lawyer, which is his earnings. And you know, I mean, it's a question of what's fair. and also what's appropriate under Gusson. Gusson says that if it has present or prospective value, that it's an asset under 580-47.
So is it your position that in dividing these contingency fee contracts, we should evaluate it as of the... Do we find a value so we can split it, or are you more concerned about determining alimony for the future? I mean, some of the cases, they use it to determine alimony.
Yeah, right? That's a good point, because two of the cases cited in the answering brief actually don't say contingency fees don't mean anything. They say make it up in a deviation or alimony. And, of course, keep in mind, if you look at the 86 pages of findings in this case, there's not a whisper about earnings before or after don't put or contingency. So there's no way this judge could have applied that to alimony because there was no findings. There's no findings about any... There's no findings at all about how much this gentleman earned over the last 10 years or the last 20 years or his active case file. So presumably, if there's no findings, the court didn't consider it when it... Now, there's a reason why he didn't consider it, because counsel argued below that since my client did not put on a case for alimony because of the whole continuance issue and the due process and all that, since she didn't put on an update asset and she didn't testify about her needs, all she said was she needed to go to the spa and all these things, because she didn't meet the first two factors, the third factor, which is the ability of the spouse to pay, was never reached. So there's a reason why there's no reference to earnings in the case in alimony. They're taking the position that unless you come up and prove first that you have a right to alimony, that the court has no obligation to figure out whether this other spouse can afford to pay it. So that makes it difficult to pay Brenda back for this hugely successful business if you just wipe out the alimony question. They do make the argument that there's a small deviation in this case. I think it's $90,000. And they gave that deviation to her. They essentially waived an equalization payment. And their position was, there, we gave it to you there. Well, again, $2 million a year, huge active case file, $90,000 is peanuts. What they actually gave her for the law firm was $27,000. That's what she got. She got half.
Do we reach that issue if we don't find that, unless we find the court erred in failing to grant the continuance and the pretrial orders? In other words, if those orders were valid and your client didn't put on evidence of that, isn't it her burden to put on some evidence to support the claim for alimony?
No, because she did testify. I agree. That's a really important point. The first argument we make in alimony is, hey, we were denied due process. That's important.
Wouldn't that be the same for the valuation of the business? In other words,
No, because
they didn't call any expert on the value of the business. The only evidence was presented by their expert.
We had two experts, Your Honor. We had Jan Weinberg and we had John Candon. They presented everything we could possibly need. What we're arguing is case law. We're not arguing the record. There's plenty of record below that he had a huge case law
business,
file.
You're saying it doesn't matter as to whether or not the rulings on the continuance and the pretrial deadlines.
No, I won't say that because I didn't argue that in my brief. I argued my brief right at the top of the issue to evaluating the law firm. I argue that we were denied due process because we couldn't put on an expert. But Lucas did a superb job cross-examining Jan and John Candon and making a record as to what exists below. And I'd submit that the question of whether or not those things can be just disregarded is a legal question. It's not a factual one. It is true that the alimony case was gutted by the continuance, and there's just no doubt about it. But I think you can also look at the judge's reasons, and I also think it's inappropriate to argue that since she didn't specify exactly how much she needs, even though she was getting $6,000 a month in preliminary alimony awarded by Judge Radius, which is certainly an indication that she had some needs before the trial. I think if you look, you have a right to go and ask yourself, if the judge doesn't even address the issue of his ability to pay, is that a fair ruling under 580-47? Counsel argues that it's not, and I understand that argument, but I don't think that's what the cases say.
When do we determine the marital? It seems like the court considered everything after they separated as non-marital property. Is that the determining date, the date of separation? I mean, I thought it was date of evidentiary part of trial.
were so many issues. Are you talking about like the law firm for starters?
No, I mean all the contingency fees that he started getting in January after the divorce.
Oh, after the report.
Action was filed.
It actually was a little bit of both. The biggest case hadn't been settled as of April. The $3 million case, which would have met $1 million fee, was pending. And it was characterized by Jan as a, quote, good case. And that was pending in April at Dokpot. But yes, there were some cases that were settled afterwards. There were three kinds of issues. There was the issue of, do you consider earnings at all? There was the issue of, do you consider earnings after the close date of the report? And do you consider cases that are pending at Dokpot? I notice my time's up. If I don't want to take any more of my time. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Your Honor. Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Charles Kleintop. I'm the lead counsel for Plaintiff Appellee Jan Michael Weinberg. Assisting me today is my associate counsel, Robert Nakatsuji. Unless the Court directs me otherwise, I would like to address the issues in this case in the chronological order in which they were presented to the family court and decided by the family court. But at the outset, I'd like to give the court a brief overview of this case, since I was the trial attorney in this case. In fact, I was Mr. Weinberg's attorney in this case from the time that the complaint for divorce was filed on December 22, 2004. I was not involved in the case, the first divorce case that was filed in March of 2004. This was an intensely litigated case, obviously. From the volumes before the court, but it was a well-presented and a well-argued case by the attorneys, in my view. And in my view, it was also a correctly decided case based upon the credible and trustworthy evidence that was presented to the family court. The family court, of course, has wide discretion in making decisions on the evidence before it, and absence of manifest abuse of discretion, those decisions should not be disturbed. What's a manifest abuse of discretion? As this court well knows, that means that the family court would have had to disregard rules or principles of law or practice to the substantial detriment of a party litigant, or make decisions that clearly exceeded the bounds of reason. That did not happen in this case. The court.
You haven't appealed the finding of the lower court that there was an agreement and contemplation of divorce.
We did not appeal that. That's correct. The finding was that there was an agreement. There was not a finding, however, that Mr. Weinberg signed the agreement incident to divorce. That was an issue at the time of the hearing. The court specifically did not find that he had signed the agreement, but she found that there was an agreement.
How could there be agreement if he didn't sign it?
I think what the court found, that whether he signed it or not, there apparently that agreement, which was signed by Ms. Weinberg back in April of 2004, that agreement, whether he signed it or not, was an agreement that reflected a meeting of the minds. I'm not saying that the court didn't intend that finding. All I'm saying, Your Honor, is that the court didn't specifically find that. But we go from there. We move forward from there.
Though if the agreement was valid and enforceable, there would have been no necessity for Mrs. Weinberg to get an expert or get ready for trial, because that agreement would basically resolve all the issues in this case.
It would have, but for the fact that it was abandoned by both parties.
Okay, I guess what I'm concerned about, the fact that her second counsel pulls out after the court finds that there is abandonment of the agreement right before Christmas. The pretrial deadlines are coming up very shortly. She can't find an attorney, and because of that, she doesn't get to put on a case to prove the value of the marital property.
That was her argument, Your Honor. That's not what the court found. And that's not what the records reflect in this case. The records reflect that Mr. Cascadens motion to withdraw, which he filed on December 8, 2005, indicated that there were many reasons why he was withdrawing. And most of those reasons involved the conduct of his client, Ms. Dixon. He said she was impossible to work with. She refused to follow his instructions. She gave him conflicting directives. She failed to follow valid family court orders. There were a whole bunch of reasons why he cited he had to withdraw. Moreover, the evidence that is also in the record was that starting in November of 2005, Ms. Dixon, was contacting Mr. Weinberg, leaving him voicemail messages, all of which we put into evidence in response to the motions to continue, showing that she was telegraphing exactly what she wanted to do. She was telling Mr. Weinberg that she was going to delay this case indefinitely. There wasn't going to be a trial here. She was going to keep making him pay on and on and on. So we can't blame Mr. Cascaden for filing the motion to withdraw that he did on December 8th. We can blame Ms. Dixon, however. And her indicating that she was going to do this actually came after that motion to set conference on October 13, 2005, where the trial was set. And it was set 5 months down the road in March of 2006. So we can't blame Mr. Cascaden for doing what he did. And we also know from the records that we subpoenaed that after Mr. Cascaden was allowed to withdraw, she took no steps to obtain replacement counsel. And why should she? Once again, she telegraphed in December through voicemail messages to Mr. Weinberg that she was intending to delay this case indefinitely. So the fault here is not on Mr. Cascaden. The fault here is on Ms. Dixon.
Well, I agree that she was her worst. She wasn't a very good client. And she was depressed, I'm sure, to be accused by her husband of forging his signature and all of that. But, I mean, Mr. Cascaden pulled out in December, and the court wouldn't continue even the pretrial deadlines or the trial. And three of the family court judges recused themselves also. And so it just seems like everything kind of worked to, you know, they kind of followed this cookie-cutter approach, and, you know, deadlines had to be met. And I realize there's a need for parties to, you know, comply with deadlines, but Judge Choi seemed to indicate that 1 year was coming up, and so there was a rush to get this trial going. What's that 1 year about?
Well, first of all, if you look at what she did after Mr. Cascaden withdrew, we have all the records that she went on a shopping spree. She spent her days at the spa. This is what she did for at least a month. She did nothing. She also did not request a continuation of the trial on December 14th at the time that Mr. Cascaden was allowed to withdraw. So there was no request for a continuance. The first evidence of contact with a lawyer is on January 20th, 2006. When we see that Ms. Purcell is now representing her. Ms. Purcell at that time could have requested a continuance, could have requested an extension of deadlines. Nothing was done.
But she did.
Not until February 24th, 2006,
and
Your Honor.
Ms. Dixon did file a motion, but she's not pro se. I think she asked for a continuance, but they never scheduled a hearing on it, and I don't think she knew that she was supposed to get the hearing scheduled.
I think you know something that I don't know, Your Honor. I'm not aware that Ms. Dixon pro se filed a motion. If she did, it was never set for hearing.
It was not set for hearing.
It was never served on me. So I'm not aware that she, on her own pro se, filed a motion to continue. What I am aware of is that Ms. Purcell was representing her starting on January 20th, 2006. She didn't file a motion to continue or extend the pretrial deadlines until February 24th, 2006, over a month later. She never contacted me and asked for an extension of the deadlines. She never did anything. Interestingly,
I think what Judge Watanabe was asking, and I had the same question, is that at that hearing when Judge Choi denied the continuance or the pretrial motion extension request, he said, well, the case is over a year old, and it's in a position to be dismissed when this matter proceeds to trial. What What does he mean by that? Apparently was one of the bases that he cited for why he denied their request for a continuance and to extend the pretrial motions. Do you know what he's talking about?
I do. The family court has a policy, which sometimes they follow and sometimes they don't, of dismissing cases that are not resolved within 1 year from the date of their filing. And this case was, of course, filed in December of 2004. We were past the 1 year. I don't think he was concerned about it being dismissed. Obviously, the cases that get dismissed normally get dismissed for want of prosecution, whereas this was an active case. And this case had been pending, however, for over a year, and since the trial had been set back in October of 2005 for March of 2006, subsequently continued to April of 2006, mediation had occurred and been unsuccessful. Discovery had been ongoing since the prior summer, formal discovery.
He's referring to the fact that, hey, this case has been around for a while. We're ready to go, so there's no reason to...
Yes, sir. That's what I recall being his intent when he made that statement, that the case had been around, there had been mediation, settlement efforts, it had been intensely litigated. The motion to set conference was back in October. Pretrial deadlines were set. The trial was set. These were all reasonable settings in family court. Cases normally get set for trial within 6 months after the motion to set conference, and then pretrial conferences get set accordingly. I'm sorry, pretrial deadlines get set accordingly, and that's what happened in this case. The primary reason he denied that motion to continue, however, we believe, was the fact that we showed that this was an intentional effort on her part to delay this case. This wasn't an intention. This wasn't something that occurred that was beyond her control. She intentionally indicated that she was going to terminate Mr. Cascaden. She intentionally indicated that she was going to delay this case as long as she could for up to a year. She took no steps whatsoever to meet the deadlines. The thing that Mr. Cascaden did before he left, he filed her list of witnesses on November 30th, 2005. Her expert witnesses and her lay witnesses, and he didn't have to do that. So he did everything he needed to do and more before he filed his motion to withdraw. She took no steps after that.
What about the fact that Mr. Weinberg was supposed to pay money for the attorney's fees into court so she could hire another attorney, and he didn't pay it? I mean, that certainly jeopardized her defense.
That was their argument, but that's not what happened. What happened was the court ordered Mr. Weinberg, instead of paying Mr. Cascaden, since there was going to be a dispute over his fees, to pay it into the court in a timely manner, which he did. So he did comply with the court's order.
But she had to order him to pay it, because she had ordered him to pay it earlier, and he didn't pay it. He was planning to pay it in January of the following year. And so she says, no, you have to pay it. And so he did do that. But in the meantime, she's trying to find an attorney, and no attorney is going to agree to be her attorney if she can't pay him.
Well, as we demonstrated, and as is in the record, when we subpoenaed her bank records, she had $72,000 spread over three accounts during the month of December. So she clearly had the ability to retain counsel. She clearly had the ability to retain expert witnesses. So this argument that she didn't have any money and was relying on that $40,000 was absolutely nonsense. She had the money. We didn't know that at the time because we hadn't completed our discovery. But when those records came in of her accounts, and we saw that she had all of this money.
You referenced the deposits. What's the evidence about the disbursement of that money? What did she spend it on? You indicated that in that time period she deposited $75,000 or $60,000. What is there in the record what that money was expended on?
There is no indication that money was actually spent. That money was deposited. There were, with the same banks, some of the same banks, there were also charge cards. But that money was deposited. Our bank records, because of the discovery cutoff deadline, brought us through January, as I recall, that we had records up till January. She still had that money in January. What, if anything, happened to it after that, we don't know.
because we had a discovery cutoff deadline.
In the relevant time period, that money was available for her to use to retain a lawyer.
Absolutely.
How is she? And she was supposed to use that money to also find a new place to live. Is that correct? I mean, all the living expenses, because you basically sold the house that she was in.
The house was not sold at that time, Your Honor. She was removed from the house.
She had to find a place to live.
So she had to find a place. That was all part of the hearing on her request for temporary alimony. So the court took into account the fact that she had been ordered to vacate the new Uano property so that it could be ready for sale and sold, and she was going to be getting presumably a rental. The court took that into account in awarding her $6,000 in temporary alimony. That was all part of the hearing on her request for temporary support. So that was already factored in. Now, the court factored in the fact that she would go get a rental, not that she would, once she left the house, would go and stay at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel for a month and make all kinds of expensive charges at that time. But that's what she did, and the record is clear on that also. So her conduct, everything that this woman did, is the reason why we opposed the motion to continue, because it wasn't a good faith request for a continuance. The fact that she didn't have a lawyer sooner than she did, and actually she had a lawyer as of January 20th, the fact that she didn't have expert witnesses, this was all her fault. She had the ability, the financial ability, to retain those experts, to retain counsel.
You did not oppose the motion to continue the pretrial deadlines, though. You said, well, no, the trial should stay. We're okay with granting the pretrial motions, but I think the judge just seemed to have overlooked that particular motion and just denied. Because there were two requests, right? Motion to extend the pretrial deadlines and motion to continue the trial. And
The motion to extend the pretrial deadlines didn't come on for hearing until April 7th, 2006, 4 days before the trial was scheduled to begin. And I believe, as I recall, I did oppose that request at that time. Now, Judge Enright made it very clear that had an offer been made by Ms. Dixon to present her exhibits at that time or deliver them to me later that day, he was probably going to extend the deadlines to allow that to happen. And I can't recall if I commented on that. Maybe I didn't oppose that, because at least if I was getting exhibits that day, then that would give me 4 days to prepare to respond to those exhibits before trial was starting, was prepared to commence. But she didn't have those exhibits. She did not want to offer those exhibits. She did not want to present exhibits until the first day of trial. Judge Enright said, that's not fair, and that's not right. But even as late as April 7th, that could have happened. If the court is referring to a request from Ms. Purcell, sometime in February, she did ask me if she could extend the deadlines to the end of March to provide, I think, responses to the outstanding discovery. And it may have been for the exhibits. I can't recall. I agreed to that. That I agreed to, because I thought that was okay. As long as I had them well in advance of time, I could go to trial. That deadline came and went, and I was provided nothing.
But the court denied the motion, right? So she couldn't.
Well, but her request to me, she requested that she have till the end of March 2006 to provide the answers to the responses to discovery and, as I recall, the trial exhibits. I accepted that. I agreed with that. But then she didn't provide them. Then the motion.
You think that wasn't pursuant to court order? That was an agreement between the parties.
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor. Then the motion to extend pretrial deadlines, the last one that was ruled on, that came on for hearing on April 7th, 4 days before the actual trial was to begin. And at that time, we were really only talking about exhibits.
But some of the exhibits, namely the IRA agreement, the so-called IRA agreement, I mean, that's an exhibit that your client was aware of, you were aware of, What would have been the prejudice to admit that particular exhibit?
Well, first of all, the exhibits were not presented that day, so I did not know what exhibits were going to be offered. So I did not know on April 7th what exhibits they were planning to offer. They didn't bring the exhibits to court. They didn't tell the court what the exhibits were going to be, except for the fact they did say that they had no expert reports, and so there were going to be no expert reports.
Right, but that particular exhibit was excluded at trial because of the failure to comply with either the pretrial deadline or the discovery response. But as respect to that particular exhibit, since you were already aware of that exhibit beforehand, would there have been any prejudice in the court allowing that particular exhibit to be admitted?
Since I did not know prior to the day that trial commenced what exhibits were going to be given, if any, or presented to me, I took the position that none of the exhibits should come in. It was a blanket.
Is that the procedure that you have to produce those documents before trial?
Yes, Your Honor. It is regularly, to avoid trial by ambush, it is regularly a pretrial deadline set forth in all pretrial orders that there will be an exchange of exhibits at a point in time, exchange of trial exhibits. So we don't have trial exhibits, people coming into court on the day of trial and presenting exhibits for the first time. So there.
This is a document that your own client produced as part of discovery, so it's not like it's a surprise.
I don't recall that my client produced. Are you talking about the IRA agreement? I don't know that he. I don't recall that he produced that in discovery. He'd certainly cooperated with all the discovery requests. But again, I did not know until the first day of trial. I didn't even really know then either, because it was dumped on me just as we're starting trial. So I did not have a chance to even review what these 32 exhibits were. And I just took the blanket position that all of them should be excluded. There was testimony about the IRA agreement, certainly at trial. And so I'm not sure that it mattered that it wasn't in, although it clearly was not in, it was not received in evidence. But we do have these rules, and I think they're important rules, that there be an exchange of trial exhibits ahead of time, that there be discovery responses given prior to trial. Our trials are important, like trials in any other court. And these pretrial deadlines are important for the exchange of exhibits, exchange of expert witness reports, completion of discovery, completion of depositions. There's nothing unusual about the manner in which cases are tried. And the bottom line on these motions to continue and the motion to extend the pretrial deadlines, the bottom line is, under all the facts and circumstances of this case, I don't think this court can say that Judge Enright or Judge Choi abused their discretion under all the circumstances of this case. I want to go back just very.
Does any of the divorce case affect the deadlines at all in family court? I mean, it seems like they have this standard 5 months here, you turn these documents, it's a pretty rigid schedule. And if the case becomes more complex because there's a disagreement over whether particular agreements are enforceable, and shouldn't there be some flexibility to extend some of these deadlines to give the parties an opportunity to prepare for trial? I mean, this is an important.
I would agree, Your Honor, and regularly deadlines are extended. They're extended by agreement of counsel. They're extended by the court. They're regularly extended to ensure that there is a full exchange of information.
But they weren't extended in this case, and it seems like it was because Judge Choi only worked 2 days a month or whatever, and so the trial had to be scheduled for a day that he was working.
Well, to be fair, Your Honor, the deadlines were set in January. The pretrial deadlines, the ones we're talking about, were in January and February. Judge Choi was not involved in this case at that time.
I thought the deadlines were set in November.
No, I'm sorry. They were set in October, but the actual deadlines were in January and February. They were January 20th, February 2nd, February 9th, and February 15th. Those were the deadlines. By the time Judge Choi was assigned the case, which was in early March, and then the trial was reset from March to April, by the first motion that he received was the motion to continue that he heard on March 8th, 2006. By that time, the deadlines had passed. Okay, there had been no request of me or the court for the extension of those deadlines. Had I received a request from Ms. Dixon or her attorney, I would have accommodated that request. I'm sure I would have extended the deadlines for both, since the deadlines were simultaneous. But since there was no request, on January 20th, I produced the expert reports. On February 2nd, I produced our trial exhibits. And by February 9th, we abided by the discovery cutoff deadline, because there was no request of me to extend deadlines. The first request that came to me was from Ms. Purcell sometime in March to extend the deadlines till the end of March, and I agreed. And then she didn't accommodate. She didn't respond. And so everything that we did under the circumstances, I think, was reasonable. There was nothing else we could do. And I think the judge acted reasonably under the circumstances. I want to come back briefly, if I could, to the abandonment issue. The key here is, what, if anything, happened after the agreement that the court found was entered into back in April of 2004? What happened from that point in time up until August of 2005, when for the first time Ms. Dixon raises the existence of this agreement? What happened was absolutely nothing. As Judge Radius found, during that period of time, neither party performed the agreement, neither party pursued it, neither party took any steps to perfect it. All of the actions of the parties from April of 2004 until August of 2005 were inconsistent with the existence of this agreement. One thing that Mr. Esser failed to mention, which we have mentioned in our answering brief, which is significant, was at that hearing on August 31st, 2005, Ms. Dixon testified that she remembered her AICD, she called it. She remembered that in January of 2005, but when she came back to Hawaii to work on this second divorce case, she wanted more. She wanted more than she was going to get under that agreement. So, because of that testimony, we now know that Ms. Chang, her attorney in the first divorce, when she filed that answer to complaint on January 13, 2005, knowledgeably didn't assert the existence or the enforceability of that AITD from the first divorce action. So clearly, there was knowledge on the part of Ms. Dixon about that agreement by her own testimony, and she didn't want it. She wanted more. And everything that happened after that reflected that. The discovery requests, which were not limited just to the representations on the asset and debt statement that Mr. Weinberg prepared back in early part of 2004, they were expansive, both the informal discovery requests and the formal discovery requests that Mr. Cascaden filed in July of 2005. So it went much beyond that. And then all of a sudden, at the end of August, for the first time, she says, well, we have this AICD. But when I questioned her at the hearing on August 31st, 2005, about her knowledge of that, she said, sure, I knew about it. When I came back to Hawaii in January 2005, I wanted to get more. I wanted to negotiate for more. So all of her actions, in fact, all of the actions of Mr. Weinberg, were inconsistent with the existence of that agreement. That's what Kuroda holds. That's what the court found. I want to speak very briefly about contingent fee cases. Contingent fee cases are unique. They are not pension plans. They are not retirement plans. They are contingent by their very nature. Contingent fee cases have nothing to do with the hours that an attorney puts in pre-divorce or post-divorce. Nothing whatsoever. What they have to do is how a case proceeds and how it resolves itself. What makes them contingent, what makes their value speculative, is that we don't know until the end of a case if there's going to be a recovery. We don't know if it's going to be a recovery by settlement. We don't know if it's going to be a recovery by trial. And we don't know if it's going to be a defense verdict or a defense judgment. We don't know any of that.
True, but a lot of the states that have determined whether at first it's marital property and have said it is marital property basically reserve jurisdiction to value the contingency agreement as they come in. So should we adopt a similar situation here? Because clearly that was his biggest asset.
But we have a problem here because we have a statute, Your Honor. We have Section 580-56, which specifically says that the family court is divested of jurisdiction to divide property 1 year following the entry of the divorce decree. So we have a problem. The court can't wait until a contingent fee case resolves itself because of that. Also, 580-47 specifically says upon the granting of a divorce, the court will divide and distribute the property in the marital estate.
Okay, so Mr. Esser suggests that in that situation you can sort of value the property like a Linson formula so you can figure out at least alimony. Couldn't you do that, kind of take an estimate of what his revenues have been over the past, over the marriage?
I'm not sure I understood the second part of your question, but let me talk about the part I do think I understand, and that is valuing a case or assigning a Linson-type formula to a case. The problem with that is what is going to be the measure. Personal injury attorneys don't keep their hours, so and it doesn't really matter because they're not compensated based on the number of hours they spent. So we can't say, well, he spends so many hours prior to the divorce and so many hours after the divorce, and that should be the basis for allocating a share of the fee ultimately when it comes in. But personal injury attorneys don't do that, and they don't have to do that because of the contingent fee nature of the case. Secondly, it's the effort that often brings about the resolution of these cases. And when I say the effort, I'm talking about the settlement effort, the discovery effort, the negotiation effort, and if need be, the trial effort. All of those things, which would be post-divorce, okay, post-divorce efforts are not shared. So if you're going to apply a Linson formula, what is your measure? It can't be hours. How would you allocate the effort? And the other problem is, of course, in personal injury cases, personal injury attorneys regularly advance thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars in costs. And those costs, if there is no recovery, have to be borne by that personal injury attorney. Is the former spouse now going to be required to pay a portion of those costs advance if there's no recovery? The application of a Linson formula also doesn't work for this reason.
Maybe I should clarify. I didn't mean Linson in the sense of a fraction. But could you take an estimate of what his net income was over the past, over his marriage, and use that to calculate, for example, alimony? He said in his asset and debt statement he was getting $42,000 a month, so we know what his income was, and the judge never found any kind of income attributable to Mr. Weinberg in this case.
Your Honor, I think the court can do that without getting into the whole valuation of the contingent fee cases. I think the court certainly can look at what the income has been during the marriage, the average income, and for personal injury attorneys, it's going to go up and down, but certainly the court can look at what the income has been average during the marriage and project what the level of income will be in the future. I think the court can absolutely do that in determining whether or not there's an ability to pay alimony. I don't think there's a problem with that. I don't think we get into the issue of the valuation of contingency fee cases, though, in order to do that. I think the court has the right to look at the income that's been earned during the marriage and make a judgment or an assessment as to, and a projection as to what the income will be in the future. We never reached that issue in this case, however, because we didn't have to. Because of the Cassidy case, which talks about the sequential determination of need and then whether or not a spouse requesting alimony can meet his or her own need either through his or her own employment efforts or through the awards of property division. If there's no need above that established, then we don't even have to look at the income situation of the party from whom alimony is being requested. And that is exactly what happened in this particular case. And therefore, Judge Choi did not have to reach the issue or make a finding as to what Mr. Weinberg's income was.
There was one thing that confused me about the expert's valuation of the law practice. I mean, he said the biggest asset of that law firm was the debt that Mr. Weinberg owed to the corporation.
Correct. It was an account receivable of the corporation,
which reduced the value of it. Which increased the value.
It increased the value.
That was basically the only asset, right? And he discounted it by the collectability by 30% or 33% or something like that.
That's correct.
So essentially, in Mr. Weinberg's practice, the way that the evaluator evaluated it, the only significant asset was the money that Mr. Weinberg owed back to the practice because he had taken a loan from the practice.
But that was also offset by the fact that that debt was reflected on Mr. Weinberg's asset and debt statement, that he had that debt to his practice. So it was offset. It was reflected in both places as it had to be. It wasn't just considered in the value of the business and ignored on the other side either.
But other than that, the business was valued essentially at zero.
It was valued based on its assets. That's correct, and which was the correct approach, valuation approach, in our view, under Antelik. And with respect to Antelik, and I recognize my time is up, contrary to what Mr. Esser said, the court did have an opportunity, the Supreme Court, the Hawaii Supreme Court, did have an opportunity in the Teller case in 2002 to visit the Antelik case. And in that case, in the Teller case, the Supreme Court cited the Antelik case with approval. So there is no compelling reason, no compelling justification to reverse what's been good, solid law in this jurisdiction since 1988 with respect to the valuation of goodwill. And the Antelik case is important because it doesn't say that goodwill cannot be valued. What it says is that every case has to be examined on a case-by-case basis. And it says that in certain cases, goodwill will be considered a marketable business asset. And in other cases, it will not be valued as a marketable business asset and therefore not part of the marital estate. In this case, and in virtually all cases where you have a sole practitioner, a sole proprietorship, where the success of the business depends on that individual's personal goodwill, that's not a marketable business asset that can be valued because it is personal goodwill. We think the approach in Antelik is a solid, sound approach, and we seek no compelling reason for it to be set aside. Thank you.
Time? Does he have any time left?
Do I have any time? 5 minutes. Okay.
First of all,
counsel never gave Ms. Purcell an extension on the exhibits. That would have been a huge thing, and he did not do that. He didn't extend any of the pretrial deadlines. All he did, and this is in the transcript when they're discussing the pretrial motions, April 11, 2006, at page 14, he gave Ms. Purcell a 2-week extension to answer interrogatories. That was his largesse. Okay, so he didn't give her any more time to do any exhibits or experts. In terms of the attorney's fee issue and this mumbo-jumbo about spending it on spas and Royal Hawaiian and all that, the bottom line is these parties went to court the first week of November 2005. She asked for $60,000 in attorney's fees. She submitted asset and debt statements and earnings and expense statements, and she got $40,000 from Judge Radius. Now, Judge Radius didn't give her $40,000 because she had billions in the bank and could pay her own fees. So, you know, throwing all that stuff at the court in April, none of which is referred to, by the way, in the findings, doesn't change the fact that there was an award of $40,000 in fees. And when they came to court on December 14th, which was 6 weeks later, not only had he not paid it, he meaning Jan, he asked until January to pay it, claiming poverty.
Explain, give me the clarity. So when was the money actually paid in?
It was paid March 24th, which was after both Cascaden and Purcell had long gone.
So what was it paid into the court?
It was paid into the court, $40,000. $10,000 went to Cascaden, $30,000 went for quote-unquote new lawyer.
Wasn't that in January?
No, it was March 24th.
I thought March 24th was when the court released, said $10,000 goes to
that's
the
right.
first attorney.
That's right.
$30,000 is available.
That's correct.
But in between then, what was the...
The status was it was paid into court.
But did your client come in and ask that a portion of that be allowed to be used?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. She filed, there's all sorts of pro se filings in January, one of which the... Judge Watanabe was referring to when she asked for the trial to be continued. It was sort of in hard to understand language, but she filed pro se papers saying, I can't do this, I need money, there's all these things happening to me, and
is there,
wasn't...
Is there a specific request that the money that's in the court now, as of January,
yes.
be allowed to be dispersed to...
Absolutely.
...place a retainer on a new lawyer?
If you look at the December 14th transcript, Your Honor, Mr. Cascaden argues, my client needs this money now. And Jan's lawyer got up there and said, we can't afford to pay it till January. We're poor. And Radius said, you've had 6 weeks already. Pay that money today. And it wasn't pay it to the court. It was pay it to Brenda so she can hire a new lawyer. So there's no issue about whether she needed attorney's fees. That was resolved by Judge Radius when she ordered the $40,000.
Was that argued to Judge Choi in connection with the motion to extend the deadlines and to ask for a continuance?
The issue of whether she could afford attorney's fees or not was in their opposing papers, but it wasn't argued by Purcell at all. All Purcell said was, there's no money. What Purcell told the judge, Your Honor, is that Brenda's mother has come up with, 81-year-old mother has paid some small amount to Purcell. And at that point, Purcell said, I've already spent more than that, and I haven't done any of the trial preparation. I've already spent more than that just preparing and appearing for this motion. It was money that she got from her mother. Now, it wasn't an affidavit or anything, but it was what Purcell said as an officer of the court, and you know, it wasn't contested. So that's where she got the money to hire Purcell, was from her mother.
Notwithstanding the fact that the pretrial deadlines had lapsed, is there any reason why counsel didn't belatedly comply with those deadlines? In other words, file the exhibits before trial, designate an expert, and then at trial argue, hey, okay, we missed the deadline, but we complied, we did do those things, give us a break, and in your discretion, because there's less prejudice now, let us use that stuff.
Okay, that's a good question. That's exactly what Judge Enright focused on April 7th. Judge Choi didn't focus on that. And by the way, Purcell did ask, as Judge Watanabe pointed out, both for a continuance and an extension of the pretrial deadlines, because just a trial extension wouldn't have helped her at all, because if all the pretrial deadlines had lapsed, she'd have a 3-month delay and she couldn't have anything anyway. So she did ask for both. And whether she should have come to the March 24th hearing, again, she still didn't have any fees from the court because that was March 8th. And they weren't released until March 24th. She had received some money from her mother, and she basically said to the court, the expert never received any information. I don't have a report. I haven't deposed Jan. I haven't deposed John Condon. I mean, she said all that stuff. It's attached to my, I attached that transcript, 32 pages to my opening brief, because I wanted you to read it. And what she says is, I need more time. She couldn't have brought an expert report. She said the expert had been named by Cascaden. It was Cuba. But there hadn't been anything accomplished at that point. And, you know, again, Purcell, I don't believe Purcell made any misrepresentations. If you look at her 32 pages, it's clear what she needs. And she couldn't have come up with an expert report because the expert hadn't even reviewed documents at that point. I think Judge Enright had a legitimate point. He said, trial's 4 days from now. Why don't you at least bring me the exhibit list, which was eventually brought on the 11th. And by the way, this document you were asking about, this IRA document, the IRA document was turned over in discovery by Jan, and not only that, it was on his proposed exhibit list. He didn't actually introduce it because when it was excluded, he left it out. But if you look at the ninth supplemental record on appeal, which was just ordered a few months ago, presumably by this panel, it attaches his exhibit list. And one of the things that was ID'd but never introduced was that agreement, the agreement on the IRAs. I mean, they knew about it. There was no surprise. You know, it's still a violation of the family court's little guidelines, but clearly there was no surprise. The issue of Antelik. Teller was my case. And I argued this in the opening brief, and anybody in a second can see that the cite to Antelik and Teller doesn't approve it. All the Teller court did, Justice Nakayama's opinion, was say the definition of goodwill in Antelik is this. It did not mention professional corporations. It didn't mention marketable. The discussion wasn't there. There was a lot of things in Antelik, and Teller didn't approve it, and it's clear.
Does a one-year jurisdictional limit for the division of property for family court create problems in terms of maybe perhaps what other jurisdictions have done in valuing contingency fee cases by waiting until the case gets resolved?
My understanding, Your Honor, and I could be wrong, but if a judge reserves jurisdiction in his divorce decree, that statute doesn't apply. That statute applies if there's a final decision in the divorce decree. In other words, you can't file a Rule 60B after a year because of the importance of finality. But it does not apply if the judge retains jurisdiction. Now, I could be wrong. And even if it does apply to civil cases, it probably doesn't apply to family court cases, because think of all the retained jurisdiction in family court cases having to do with, say, alimony. One of the main reason they didn't want alimony is, in fact, the only reason that Jan argued on the stand was we don't want her to get alimony because she'll come in here 2 years from now and say she needs more. So clearly the court retains jurisdiction for alimony and for child support and for custody. And if it retains jurisdiction pursuant to the contingency fees, it can do so. But even if the 1 year applies, 1 year is a long time. And you could certainly achieve a lot of fairness if you came back 11 months later and saw how many cases had been resolved. And by the way, the question Your Honor asked, Judge Watanabe asked about, couldn't they look back over the last 10 years and see what his average earning capacity was? That precise question was asked by Lucas to Candon. That's what she said. She said, can't we look back over the last 10 years and estimate because there's this huge active case file, John Candon. Can't we estimate based on the $2 million a year that he's had? And Candon said, no, we can't. It's speculative, which, of course, is the debate in those cases. Again, I really invite this court to look at the Estes decision because it essentially says flat out, just because it's not easily valuable doesn't mean we throw out the baby with the bathwater. And that seems to be the majority view. That doesn't mean it has to be the Hawaii view, but it is interesting to me that the logic that comes up against this rule, if you look at the decisions, the Georgia decision, the Goldstein decision that they cite off, that's a page and a half decision without any analysis whatsoever. The Estes decision and the Garrett decision, I think that's the name of it, from Arizona, are well-thought, reasoned decisions like Professor Oldman's discussion that say, you know, this is just too important, and it doesn't just apply. There's even an ALR article on it cited in our brief. And this doesn't involve just attorneys. It involves every professional in this state, for that matter, judges. And the problem is that you can't take the single most important asset and throw it out just because it's a problem. Anyway, I see my time's up. Any other questions? Thanks.
Thank you. I'll take the matter under advisement.